Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Just about everyone on the planet knows who said, "Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed." Neil A. Armstrong's name was virtually unknown until that July night in 1969. He and Buzz Aldrin became the first humans to land on the moon. Anyone my age or older certainly remembers where they watched the moonwalk, the ghostly black and white images of Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon. The success of Apollo 11 and its crew of Armstrong, Aldrin, and Command Module pilot Michael Collins achieved President John F. Kennedy's goal of successfully landing a man on the moon by the end of the decade and thrust the three of them into the glaring spotlight of celebrity. Of the three, the first man on the moon, Commander Armstrong, became the most reticent when it came to doing interviews for the media, so it was huge news when he finally agreed to have his biography written. Our guest is the man he chose to write his life story. James R. Hansen is a professor emeritus of history at Auburn University in Alabama and a former historian for NASA. His biography, titled First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong, was first published in 2005. With Armstrong's passing in 2012, the time became right to turn his story into a major motion picture, and the new biopic starring Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy is about to be released in the U.S. A new edition of Hansen's book was released earlier this year in anticipation not only of the film, but of the upcoming 50th anniversaries of the Apollo flights from 1968 to 1972. Professor Hansen joins us via Skype from his home in Auburn. James Hansen, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Hey, let's go back in time. Let's go into the Wayback Machine. And it's July 20th, 1969, a Sunday night. Where were you? Do you remember that?
Well, I'm in front of the television set on the floor, as close as I can get to the screen. It's the summer between my junior and senior years of high school, so I've been taking college aptitude tests, and I'm working at a golf course mowing grass, but I'm in front of the television set watching every second of the Apollo moon landing.
Wow. And I think you weren't alone in that.
No, millions and millions of people worldwide were seeing it. I think it set a record. I'm not sure what the final numbers were. I remember Walter Cronkite from CBS, who I think the majority of the American audience was watching and listening to. I think he, at one point, I remember him, you know, estimating that the crowd worldwide that was paying attention to this was, you know, somewhere less than a billion people that were actually following it live.
Well, let's fast forward then to the future. And when did you first get interested or have the idea in your mind that you wanted to be the biographer of Neil Armstrong?
Well, it came about 20 years into my career, and I don't think I would have had much of a chance to convince Neil to let me go ahead if I hadn't had the background experience. My PhD was in the history of science and technology from Ohio State, and I finished that in 1981. And NASA hired me immediately out of graduate school to write a book for them about the history of the oldest NASA facility, which actually goes back even before NASA was established to an organization known as the NACA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, which was created in World War I. I had probably done four books and several articles by the time the late 1990s roll around. I'm teaching full-time at Auburn University. We have a number of master's and doctoral students specializing in aerospace history. And I'm teaching a graduate seminar in space history. And the first day of class, you know, I go around the room and everybody introduces themselves and expresses what interest they might have in a research topic. And when I was done with the students telling me what they were interested in, this one of the students asked me, well, what are you going to do next? And I, you know, kind of on the spot, I said, well, I would like to write a biography. I'm always, even in the books I'd written, even though none of them had been biographical, I'd always been interested in the people and how engineers solve problems creatively. And I said, I'd like to do an astronaut biography, but the one that really interests me is Neil Armstrong. And from what I know, he's extremely private and hard to get to, and I don't really think I have much chance to do it. But they all encouraged me. They said, you should write him and see if you can, you know, go ahead and do this. And so that's what happened. I wrote Neil, and you know, it became about a 2-year journey from that point to really persuade him to give me the green light, because it wasn't something he agreed to immediately. But I had the patience and the persistence, and I guess just you know, Neil knew some of I shared some of my earlier books with him, and he knew that I would take his engineering seriously. And I think that was really a crucial part of why, in the end, he decided to let me go ahead.
Was there a personal meeting maybe that kind of put it over the top where he agreed to give you the thumbs up?
Yeah, there was. I think probably several months into our correspondence, he invited me to Cincinnati. He lived in a suburb of Cincinnati, and invited me to come and spend the afternoon with him. And I did that, and it went very, very well. I mean, we had a great conversation. I mean, I had, by that time, I had almost 20 years of experience writing about American aerospace development. And so many of the people I'd already interviewed, Neil actually knew personally. And so there was a lot that we had in common in terms of, you know, my knowing the history of certain things that he had been involved in. And it went extremely well. But there was not I left his home that day pretty confident that things would work out, but it actually took probably another year before I had the final agreement from him.
Wow. And once you did, it strikes me that he really let you dive deep and write the book that you wanted to write without any real interference. And I find that quite amazing.
Well, I did at the time, and I do even more now. I mean, I can't think really of another astronaut that would have allowed the independence that Neil gave me. Basically, he agreed, you know, to the interview time that I had asked for, which was considerable number of hours. I ended up having about 55 hours of tape recorded interview with him, and also access to his personal papers. He also wrote a "To Whom It May Concern" letter, because I was going to need to interview a lot of, you know, people that, and not just fellow astronauts, but lots of people that came into his life, including family members and friends, and of course, colleagues in aerospace. And they all knew how private he was. And without a letter from him confirming that, you know, he had given me, he was going along with my project, you know, I probably wouldn't have been able to interview them either. But yeah, I mean, he basically just answered my questions and never tried to influence my interpretation or tell me what he thought I needed to cover. I mean, I did have him read the book for accuracy. I mean, it would have been silly of me not to make use of that. And he had, you know, we went over the manuscript chapter by chapter over many days. And there were some things that he caught that he thought I could sharpen up just in terms of something being more accurate, but never really tried to. And he never guided me to say, Jim, you need to talk about this subject or you need to talk about that subject. If I wasn't smart enough, if I hadn't done my homework to know that there was something significant for him to tell me about, you know, he wouldn't have done it. I mean, he answered the questions I asked.
And it's a very extensive biography, and it does require the reader to invest in time, but it's a book that I've read 3 times now. And just for our listeners, well worth the time spent. You really do a fantastic job of taking us inside of his life. But before we go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I realized, I think at the time, and I realize it even more now, of course, he died in 2012, that this was going to be a one-time opportunity for history, really, because he was not going to do this again. I was quite sure of that. I was, you know, it was lucky that we got it done once, and it wasn't going to happen again. And I was pretty confident that he wasn't going to write. You know, he might write some things for publication. In fact, he was writing something for publication when he died, but it wasn't autobiographical. It wasn't really a memoir. It was more straight, you know, writing about his ideas about technology and science and space. And so I figured, you know, look, in what details would there be if someone had access to Christopher Columbus or Leif Erikson, you know, or some great explorer, you know, and had the kind of access to them that I have to Neil? What details would we want them to say, okay, that's okay, just leave that out, we're not interested? I figured, you know, if it was something that I found important, interesting, you know, something that we would never ever be able to read anywhere else, I figured it really needed to be in my book. Of course, I wanted and I tried very hard to make it as readable as possible. It's not an encyclopedia article, or, you know, it is encyclopedic in some respects. But, you know, yeah, readers need to be a little patient with it, and especially on the technical side. But they must realize that was really the main reason I think that Armstrong agreed to let me do it. He knew that I would take his engineering and the technical side of his career seriously. And you can't, I mean, if you're writing about an engineer, and first and foremost, Neil was an engineer, you just can't have, you know, a book that dismisses that and just pretends that you can write a biography without dealing with the technical subjects that was what occupied him, you know, 8 hours a day for many, many years. So that's my explanation of the detail in the book.
Well, it's like I said, it's well worth the time invested in reading, and I learn new things every time I read it. But before we go on, I want to talk about that this book's been turned into a major Hollywood film, First Man, which is coming out in theaters in October. Tell us about where you were last night.
Well, last night I was in Houston, Texas at Space Center Houston, which has a very large theater that used to be an IMAX, but they've converted it into a what they call a 4K theater, a big, big, big screen. There were 500 plus people in the audience, including some of the legends of the American space program, who, of course, are living in the Houston area and received special invitations to this screening of the movie. For example, Chris Kraft, who was the original flight director for the manned space program, Gene Kranz, who became one of the important flight directors, and of course we know him, you know, in culture as, you know, Ed Harris, the actor who played him in the movie Apollo 13. A lot of prominent people from the space program were there. Fred Hayes, the Apollo 13 astronaut, was in the audience, and so it was really a special evening to show the film to people who really knew the history. I introduced the film briefly and then did a Q&A with the audience afterwards, and the reception of the movie was pretty tremendous. So, and that was a tough crowd. I mean, of all the audiences that could watch the movie, the people that were, you know, when you have an audience where people actually participated directly and for many years in the program that led to the moon landing, and they're watching now a movie, you know, that's a pretty tough crowd. And if you can please them, you know, you really have something that's going to stand out.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll continue our interview with James Hansen, author of the Neil Armstrong biography, First Man. And we're back. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to our conversation with James Hansen, author of First Man. The book is the basis for the new film by director Damien Chazelle, starring Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong and Claire Foy as his wife, Janet. When did you find out that the rights to your book to make a film had been purchased?
Well, actually, the interest from Hollywood came even before I got a good start on the book. The fact that Armstrong had agreed to a biography made news in and of itself in the early 2000s. And so once that news, you know, made it into the papers, Hollywood came to my agent. I had an agent for the first time in my life because the book was being published by a major New York trade press, Simon & Schuster. And so we got contacted by Warner Brothers on behalf of Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood was interested in making the film, and he was making all of his films. I think he has mostly in his whole career with Warner Brothers. So we heard that Eastwood was interested, and Eastwood invited Neil and me and our wives to come out to his private golf club called Tehama, which is just up above Pebble Beach in the hills of Carmel. And we met and we had lunch together, and Neil and I and Clint played a round of golf. And then we had dinner and we talked about the movie possibilities. And at that time, everything was still pretty tentative because, as I said, I hadn't even really gotten a great start on the book yet. But after that meeting, Clint went ahead and Warner Brothers offered to purchase the option on the book when it was done. And so that was we had a deal for a film even before the book was finished.
And then, of course, Damien Chazelle, who directed La La Land, and the film stars Ryan Gosling as Neil, and Claire Foy, who's famous for The Crown on Netflix, plays his wife, Janet. And I'm just curious, as the author, you know, you've seen the film, how do you think it turned out?
Well, I guess I should say first, David, that, you know, what happened was that Eastwood, for whatever reason, decided, you know, not to make the film. And so Warner Brothers did not renew the option, and it was picked up immediately by Universal. And that was, gosh, that was probably 2006 or 2007. And it's been sitting, you know, as a property that Universal has had the rights to until Chazelle came along a few years ago. And, you know, this brilliant young director that all of the movie studios wanted to work with. And Universal went over the different properties that they had the rights to try to interest Chazelle in one of them. And it was the First Man project that interested Chazelle. And as he has said to media in the recent months, he said that he and Gosling were talking about First Man. And, you know, Damien wanted Ryan as Neil Armstrong in the film, even before La La Land got started. So it goes back a ways. But your question is, what do I think of the film? I mean, I've seen it now 6 times. In the early versions were, you know, cuts that, you know, have been changed somewhat. But now the film I saw last night in Houston is the finished product. And it's a brilliant, stunning film. It really is. It's very different than what people probably will expect. It's a very personal story. It's really the personal journey of Armstrong from the last years of his being a test pilot out on the Mojave in California to his becoming an astronaut to the moon landing itself. But it's really his story and his family's story. It's the story of his relationship with his wife and his children. And it's a story thus that everyone might think we know, but there's a lot about the personal side of Armstrong's story that really was not known and is not known well. And so the take on the film, you're not watching a documentary. You're not watching The Right Stuff. You're not watching Apollo 13. You're not watching the way HBO produced the miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, all of which I loved and have watched many, many times. But this is a very different sort of film. It's got a dark side to it in the sense that it really emphasizes the sacrifice and the loss and even the death that enveloped really the effort to go to the moon and to show exactly how hard it was to get it done. I mean, when we look back on the moon landings, I think, you know, we know that they occurred, and there's kind of a glow about them as if somehow this was, and in retrospect, people might assume, well, this was kind of easy to do. It must have been easy. We did it six times. Of course, we tried one time. We didn't get there with Apollo 13. But this movie really shows, you know, how extremely difficult and how much loss and risk and death was involved in all of this. And so the movie has a much harder edge to it than you've seen in any of those previous productions.
Let's talk about the life of Neil Armstrong. Could you briefly tell us a bit about his upbringing in, you know, I just, as a kid growing up, you know, the name Wapakoneta, Ohio became instantly important to me because that's where he was from. Tell us just a bit about his parents.
Well, his parents were Viola and Stephen Armstrong. Both of them had, I mean, they grew up in Northwestern Ohio. They were both from farming families. Neither one of them had college educations. The father, Stephen, was an accountant who worked for the state of Ohio as an auditor and basically would go from county to county to audit the books of the county for the state. And because of that, this is significant for Neil's early life because it meant that the family moved a lot. You know, that when Stephen moved to a new county to do the books for that county, the family went along. And so by the time Neil was 11 years old, they probably lived in seven different Ohio towns. And most of these towns, I mean, the county seat was usually where they went. But none of those towns were especially large. Wapakoneta is, of course, a special town in Neil's life because not only would he end up living there, his family would move there when he was, you know, in the eighth, ninth grade stretch. But he was actually born on a farm, his grandfather's farm, his mother's parents' farm outside of Wapakoneta a few miles. So he was actually born near Wapakoneta, and then the family, you know, ended up settling back there. But before he got to Wapakoneta, he was, you know, if you follow his boyhood, he lived in other towns, and the towns of St. Mary's, Ohio, the town of Upper Sandusky. For Neil, those towns really, in some ways, were as close and to his heart as Wapakoneta was. And they sometimes get, it's interesting, these little towns in Ohio, you know, they have such a pride in being connected to Neil's story. But Wapakoneta seems to claim it all when, in fact, you know, some of Neil's best friends who he had to his dying day were friends he made in Upper Sandusky, for example. So it was he was purebred a Midwestern American, you know, and very much from a rural type of family, very, you know, kind of a middle class rural family, small town. And it's amazing how many of the early astronauts, if you look at the Mercury 7 or even the New Nine, which was the second group that Neil was a part of, so many of them, a great majority of them, grew up in small towns. And so I think there was something about small town life and the values of small town life that really were formative for these young men who then went on to, many of them into military service where they, you know, where they tuned their flying skills. And then the timing was just right for them, given, you know, men born about 1930 were well positioned to, you know, they were about 30 years old then when the space age started. And if they had a flying background like Neil did, you know, the opportunities to, you know, to consider joining up with NASA and becoming an astronaut was there for them.
Well, let's fast forward to his test flying at Edwards Air Force Base after his naval aviator career. And I believe, was it there that there was a tragedy that happened in their family? Could you tell us a bit about Karen?
Yeah. Neil and Janet, his wife, they had their first child was a little boy, Eric, who they called Rick. And he was born in I think 1957 or 58. Then the second child was a little girl named Karen Ann. And Neil had a nickname for her, Muffy, which was a shortened muffin. And this little girl in 1961 was at when she was just into her twos. She was 2 years old in a few months. She was diagnosed with a very malignant brain tumor, a glioma of the pons. And, you know, it was, there wasn't much they could do. They took her to the best hospitals in Los Angeles, which were nearby the Mojave Desert, where Edwards Air Force Base and the NACA and NASA facility was located for test flying. And they did everything they could. In fact, they even put the little girl through cobalt radiation, which was very severe, the kind of the last desperate attempt to stop the growth of the tumor. And it didn't work, and the radiation treatments were horrible. The little girl had learned how to walk, but she lost the ability to walk because of the radiation, and she died at home in late January of 1962. And it was the losing a child is the worst loss a family obviously can have. A lot of marriages don't survive the loss of a child. And this Neil story, both in terms of his personal, his marriage, his family, but also his career and his flying. I mean, Neil, when you lose a child, it's going to have effects. As Neil said to me, and this is a line they use directly in the movie now, when I asked him whether the death of Karen had any effect, what sort of effect it had on his flying, even in the immediate weeks after her death, he said it would be unreasonable to assume that it would have no effect. And that's kind of classic Armstrong speak, you know, which is kind of an oblique way, but very meaningful. And so the book, my book and the movie explores the theme of the impact of the little girl's death on Neil and on his family and on his career choices, because just a few months after Muffy's death, Neil throws his hat into astronaut selection and is selected to become part of the second group of astronauts. It's announced in September of 1962.
Yes, the New Nine, which was quite an incredible collection of astronauts. If I was going to, you know, pick one group of astronauts that were the finest ever, it would be that group.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I mean, not that there haven't been some outstanding groups, but you've got, you know, the likes of Jim Lovell and Frank Borman and Ed White. That was quite a group. Pete Conrad. It was a fantastic group, and this was a group that's, you know, some of the Mercury astronauts stayed around for the later programs, but it will be mostly the New Nine from which the commanders of the moon landings will be chosen.
Well, let's talk about his first astronaut mission, Gemini 8, with Dave Scott, because that was a particularly harrowing experience. Could you just briefly tell us what happened there?
Well, it was an important flight in the Gemini program, which a lot of people forget about Gemini because it's squeezed between Mercury and Apollo and people don't understand what it was about. Basically, once NASA knew that it was going to go to the moon via the lunar orbit rendezvous concept, the key to getting the moon mission done was, well, among other things, was learning and practicing how to do rendezvous and docking in space. That was probably considered to be the most difficult challenge. And they had accomplished rendezvous in an earlier Gemini flight, but it was up to Dave Scott and to Neil, who was commanding Gemini 8, to accomplish not only rendezvous, but the world's very first docking. And what they were going to dock with was an unmanned craft that had been launched a little earlier called the Agena. So the Agena got launched, it was up in orbit, and it was up to the Gemini 8 spacecraft to go hunt it down in Earth orbit and rendezvous and dock with it. And they successfully docked, and it was, in fact, the world's first docking. But once they were docked together, all of a sudden the combined spacecraft went into a tumble and went into a spin, and they expected the Agena had some problems in its development, and so there was a bias going into the flight that if something went wrong in the docking and something like this happened, it was probably going to be because of the Agena. So Neil and Dave tried their best to sort of dampen out the motions and get this combined spacecraft stable, but it didn't work. And so their only choice was to back off and to de-dock, to move off of the Agena. But when they did, much to their surprise, the spinning got a lot worse. I mean, they were turning almost, faster than one revolution a second, and they were getting to the point of passing out. And if they did that, we would have had two dead astronauts in Earth orbit, and that would have been a terrible, and who knows what would have happened. Maybe the program wouldn't have even continued. There would have been a lot of calls by Congress, I think, maybe, and others to end it. But what they did is they managed to get out of the spin. Neil opened up the thrusters on the reentry control system and was able, by using what had happened with the Gemini spacecraft, is one of the thrusters had stuck open. And so that thruster was causing all of the spinning motion. And so the only thing they could do was to kind of counter the movements of that thruster, because there was no way to isolate which thruster was doing what. And so what they had to do is open up the other thrusters that were available to them. But the mission rules said that if you open up the reentry control system, the RCS as it was called, then the mission rule was you got to come down, because you're using fuel that you will need to navigate back through the atmosphere, because you couldn't come back to Earth just any old way. You had to come back at the right angle through the atmosphere. And so once they opened up the RCS, they had to come down. So when they came down and splashed down and recovered, they weren't supposed to land in the Pacific Ocean, but they were supposed to be in the Caribbean, but they came down whenever they could. But they got them back safely. And Neil was pretty disappointed that the flight turned out the way that it did, as was Dave Scott. Dave Scott was supposed to do a very significant EVA, or extravehicular activity, a spacewalk, and that they couldn't do that. So there were some questions about whether the Armstrong and Scott could have done something differently than they did. There was some Monday morning quarterbacking from some of the other astronauts, but the NASA people who looked at what actually had happened concluded that they did the only thing they could to save their lives and to save the mission. So it's a very dramatic moment in the American space program. It's when we very well could have lost a couple of astronauts. And I think what Neil did to save Gemini 8 and save themselves was not held against him. In fact, I think in the end, it was seen as some very quick thinking and some good piloting. When the time came to choose a commander for the Apollo 11 mission, and people had forgotten, Gemini 8 was not something that hurt Neil's chances to be put on that mission.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom, and we're talking to James Hansen, author of First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's hear the conclusion of our interview with James Hansen, author of the biography of Neil Armstrong that's the basis for the new film, First Man. You quoted to me something that Michael Collins said about them. Could you tell us a bit about what they were like as far as their personalities and how they meshed?
Right. Mike Collins, the command module pilot for Apollo 11, you know, has written a couple of very good books. I think, you know, I would recommend Mike's books, autobiographical books, probably over any other memoir written by the astronauts. But in one of his books, Mike, in talking about the Apollo 11 crew, his crew, Neil's crew, Buzz's crew, called the three of them amiable strangers. Amiable strangers. In other words, they were amiable to one another. They were friendly enough, but they remained strangers. They didn't really get to know each other personally in any close personal ways the way a lot of other crews did. And I think this phrase, amiable strangers, would not apply, does not apply to any other crew. There were some crews, in fact, the very next Apollo crew, Apollo 12, which was commanded by Pete Conrad and included Alan Bean and Dick Gordon. Of course, they were all Navy guys, so they were all from one service, but they were like, you know, they were like buddy buddies. I mean, they trained together, they ate lunch together, they had drinks together, you know, they did everything together. Whereas the Apollo 11 crew, they did their jobs, while they were in training, they, you know, did their jobs, but when they left, they took off in three separate cars, three separate ways. They did not develop the personal friendships that you have in a lot of the other crews. And that makes Apollo 11 very unique and very interesting to study, because you might think, well, you know, if they're amiable strangers, I mean, that doesn't sound very good, you know, for the way a crew has to work together as a team. But I think they went through such extensive training, and Neil, you know, made sure that all three of them did, you know, knew their jobs and knew how to do them well. And as long as they were doing their jobs in the spacecraft, everything would be fine. And that's how it turned out. But it's a very unique threesome to put together in a spacecraft when they're really strangers to one another in most every way except for professional performance.
Well, we're going to spend more time on Apollo 11 in a future program to celebrate the 50th anniversary of that. But I would like to just touch on a couple of things, which the actual landing was featured some computer alarms. The computer became overloaded, and that's been, you know, made much of that over the years. And they became low on fuel. Neil had to fly over a boulder field to set down in a safe spot. Could you just tell us a bit about how dangerous was that landing?
Well, you know, I recently gave a talk up at the University of Buffalo, and I entitled my talk Apollo 11, the most dangerous mission in history. And I had a question mark at the end of the title, because I really wanted to explore the issue, the question, was Apollo 11 the most dangerous, certainly of the Apollo missions? And I started by saying, I think the only one that could compare, that could maybe rival Apollo 11, was Apollo 8, which was in December 1968, commanded by Frank Borman, which was the first circumlunar flight. This was a very audacious, the lunar module wasn't ready yet to fly, so NASA came up with this idea, well, let's take a command and service module and let's not only fly it to the moon, let's put it in lunar orbit and orbit a few times and come back. And there were a lot of firsts in that, in terms of the Saturn V rocket, in terms of you know, leaving Earth orbit for the first time. It was the first time with human beings that human species had ever left Earth orbit. But the thing that Apollo 11, and this was my conclusion in my talk, was that Apollo 11 had to do everything, and then it also had to land. And the landing was always considered to be, you know, one of if not the highest risk, because you had to come down in a machine. I mean, the lunar module was a brilliantly designed and manufactured machine by Grumman. But, you know, when Neil and Buzz got in the lunar module and detached from the command module in lunar orbit and headed down, they'd never flown the thing before. I mean, there was no way I mean, you had to be in the lunar environment for that machine to fly. Now, they had had simulators. They had something called the Lunar Landing Training Vehicle, which was a very odd vehicle that was designed to simulate lunar landings. And Neil had to eject from the thing in May of 1968 before it crashed on him. It was a very dangerous machine to fly, so dangerous that the NASA management wanted to shut down the LLTV program. But Neil and the other commanders thought that it was so helpful in learning and having them learn how to fly that they needed to keep it working, which they did. So, but again, when they get out and when they're in the lunar module heading down, that's the first time that machine's ever flown, and the first time they've actually flown a real lunar module. And so, you know, there's a lot that has to be done correctly, and the computer, there is an onboard computer to help them with navigation and control, but it's, you know, the computer capacity's less than what we have in our cell phones by quite a bit, and the data that was coming into the computer, especially once the landing, I mean, there was radar on the lunar module that would get readings from about distance to the lunar surface, and at times the computer got overloaded, and that's when these program alarms, 1202, 1201, 1204, and I mean, the fact that there were 1204 at least computer code warnings suggested right there how, you know, how complex this all was. But basically, the alarms were not as significant as, thank goodness, as they might have, as they some feared they might be. They basically were saying the computer was having a hard time catching up. But Neil and the control of the LEM was going, as far as Neil was concerned, was proceeding well enough. And when Mission Control told them that they were go, that the computer alarms were not something that they needed to abort over, that the computer would catch up, or they could, you know, they just didn't have to worry about those alarms. You know, first for Neil and for Buzz, the alarms were more of a distraction than they were any significant problem. The fuel, on the other hand, because the lunar module was being taken down by the computer into an area that wasn't ideal. You mentioned the boulder field. There were rocks the size of Volkswagens that the computer was taking them down into, and then there was at least one very large crater that they had to, you know, in the end fly over. Neil took over manually and flew. I mean, it wasn't ever thought that they were going to, they thought the lunar module would come down not necessarily vertically, but mostly vertically. But Neil, when he took over in order to get over the boulder field and the crater, you know, he had to fly the LEM almost on a horizontal plane. And that used up more fuel than what was expected. And so the fuel call started to get very concerning to the astronauts. They were, in the end, they think maybe there were 20 to 30 seconds of fuel left on the LEM. So Neil knew he had to get it down. But in talking to him, he felt that, you know, that he was never terribly worried about the fuel situation, although people in Mission Control were, and maybe Buzz was. But Neil felt that he knew where he wanted to get to. He had spotted a place on the other side of the boulder field, on the other side of the crater. He saw a flat spot, and he felt that he had enough fuel.
Wow. Well, and one of the interesting things about, and we need to leave Apollo 11 soon and go on with Neil's life, but one of the interesting things to me about the surface mission is there are no photographs of Neil Armstrong on the moon.
Yeah, that's true, and it's unfortunate. I mean, Neil, some people say it's because Neil had the camera the whole time, and Buzz didn't have any, didn't take any of the photos, and that's simply not true. Neil did start out with the camera, but he could take it off. It was attached to the front of his suit, and so he took all the pictures that we have seen, the brilliant color photography of the Hasselblad camera. Those are pictures that Neil took of Buzz coming down the ladder, Buzz saluting the flag, And one does ask. I asked Buzz the question, why didn't you take any pictures of Neil? And Buzz's answer was that, well, it wasn't in the mission plan for him to be taking any pictures of Neil. And it's true that it wasn't in the mission plan, but both Neil and Buzz took lots of pictures that weren't in the mission plan. So, you know, it's just unfortunate. The only pictures you see of Neil that Buzz took, you can see part of a leg or part of a backpack. And to get a picture of Armstrong fully, you know, a full Neil Armstrong on the moon, what we've had to do in recent years is there was a film camera running in the window of the LEM looking out, and by stopping one of the frames of that recording and enhancing it with its resolution, we've been able to create a picture of Neil Armstrong, and we can sort of see his face. But it's a shame that we don't have, you know, the really good pictures. I mean, people think when they see the picture of the astronaut coming down the ladder or saluting the flag, they imagine that it's Armstrong. It's often misidentified that way, but those are all pictures of Buzz.
Well, after the success of Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong becomes a name for the history books, one of the most famous people in the world. And it has a tremendous cost, you know, that kind of fame. In fact, most of the astronaut marriages broke apart. The only crew that I know of that still has intact marriages is the Apollo 8 crew. Could you tell us a bit about, you know, the difficulties of being the wife of Neil Armstrong for Janet?
For Janet, I think the difficulties just are exacerbated after Neil becomes the icon, first man, and there are so many pressures on him to do events and give talks and just be available. And Neil was not the type of personality who enjoyed, you know, that kind of public attention and did his best to try to lead a normal life. The relationship between Neil and Janet, which the movie explores and I explore at some length in the book, I think is problematic almost from the start. And again, the death of the little girl, of their daughter, in 1962, January 62, that's a death that impacted that marriage in very significant ways, although unspoken ways. The very interesting thing, I had 16 hours of recording with Janet, and Janet died just a few months ago, but my interviews with her were back in 2004. And they were very difficult interviews for her to do. For one thing, she and Neil had divorced in 1994 and Neil had remarried. And for her to recall, you know, her life with him, the death of the daughter. I mean, all of the astronauts' wives, I mean, they're the unsung heroes of the space program, in the sense that the wives were there. The husbands were so committed, so dedicated, had such schedules to meet, so many demands on their time, that they were absent from their families in major respects. And it was up to the wife to keep, you know, really to keep the family together. And at the same time, you have husbands that are going off to, I mean, they're going to Earth orbit and they're going to the moon, and the daddy and husband might not come back. And so the story of the wives, and I think we do a brilliant job in the movie. Claire Foy, as you said, plays Janet, and she is so good. The two sons of Neil and Janet, Mark Armstrong and Rick Armstrong, they just feel like, you know, that Claire, you know, it just did a perfect job as their mother. I think she does as well. But the relationship with Neil and Janet was a difficult. But what's interesting is, as difficult as it was and as problematic as it was, they do stay together into the 1990s, much longer than a lot of the astronaut couples do. It's, you know, as a biographer, I kept rooting for them to, you know, for Neil to open up with her a little bit more. I mean, one of the problems that Janet had with him is that he was the type of man who just didn't engage. You know, she needed him to talk to her about certain things. For example, the death of the daughter. And, you know, Janet told me Neil never talked about the daughter. He wouldn't talk about her with anyone, not even with his wife. And Janet needed her husband to be there for her, to help her through the grief as well. But Neil just went back to work. So it's a very interesting marriage to study. And also to, you know, as I'm writing it, I'm rooting for things to get better, because I know in the end that divorce is coming. And it just amazed me that it took as long as it did. And I think Janet, I mean, back in the 1960s, I think couples didn't divorce as quickly, as easily as they do now. When she was the astronaut's wife, there was such a public light on the relationships, and she didn't, you know, and her children were little. And so I think she felt it was her responsibility to stay with the family and do the best. Then I think she was hoping that when Neil left NASA and he took a job as a university professor at the University of Cincinnati, that things would get better. She thought that things would get better when the boys were, when they became empty nester and the boys were off to college, but it never really happened. So in the late 1980s, she left Neil, left him a note on the kitchen table, told him she was going out to their second home, their vacation home out in Utah, and that she wanted a divorce, that she had just couldn't deal with Neil's personality anymore. So it's a very, you know, it's a very unfortunate, you know, but very interesting marriage and family relationship to sort of try to understand.
Well, my final question for you is, at the end, after being his Boswell, were you friends with Neil Armstrong?
Yeah, I think we were. I think it was important for me not to try to be a friend of his when I was working on the book, because I needed to keep my objectivity as a scholar. I knew there might be some tough issues about his life that I would need to discuss and write about. And so I just didn't feel it was appropriate to even try to become his friend. But we were always friendly. And then after the book came out, and you know, the compliment Neil gave me was that I wrote exactly the book I told him I was going to write, which was a great compliment coming from him, given how many times people had told him one thing and then tried to get him to do another.
Well, James Hansen, author of First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong, thanks so much for sharing your wonderful biography with the world, and which has been made into this film. And I think it's going to be just a great legacy for you to pass on, because without your biography, we wouldn't really know this man. So I was thinking about it today, and when I think about what you did, I'm going to call you Best Man, because I think you're the best person who could have possibly written the story of Neil Armstrong.
Thank you very much, David. I appreciate it.
Thanks to our guest, James R. Hansen, Professor Emeritus of History at Auburn University and author of First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes anytime at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to us at NPR Podcasts. We're distributed by PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. And finally, we want to bid fond farewell to our longtime friend, engineer, and producer, the man on the board, Nolan Ford, who's headed to LA to pursue a career in film editing. We wish him well. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.